to Sports Science Dudes. I'm your host, Dr. Jose Antonio, with my co-host, Dr. Anthony Ricci. If you're a first-time listener, hit the subscribe button and like the show. We are on YouTube, Rumble, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. So plenty of places to hear the podcast. Today, our special guest is Dr. Grant Tinsley. He's an associate professor and the director of the Energy Balance and Body Composition Laboratory at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. That's like in the panhandle, the middle of nowhere, I think. And Tony and I are fans of Texas. So, you know, if you're
from there 12 years, not in Red Raider country, but it's a great place.
Yeah, I was there. I was there 10 years in the Metroplex. I did my PhD at UT Southwestern Medical Center. So we love Texas. So we applaud you for being in Texas. So you earned your PhD in kinesiology and exercise and nutrition from Baylor University. That's in Waco, Texas. That's after completing your bachelor's degrees in nutritional sciences and physiology at Oklahoma State, as well as a master's degree in biomedical sciences from Colorado State University. You are also a certified sports nutrition, CISSN from the ISSN, and also a certified strength and conditioning specialist with distinction through the NSCA. Your current research interests, which we will talk about on this show, evaluation of body comp techniques, and I have a lot of questions for that, as does Tony, I'm sure. The influence of intermittent fasting on resistance training adaptations, as well as sports nutrition strategies to improve performance and body composition. You're well-published, over 100 peer-reviewed journal articles, and also you've directed many, many externally supported projects, well over a dozen. So let's welcome Dr. Grant Tinsley. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to be chatting with you guys today.
Well, Tony and I are happy to have you. And I know I want to start with sort of a pragmatic question, because this is a question everybody asks, not just me, but Tony, but every damn personal trainer in every gym. When you do a body composition assessment of a client, I know I actually was a personal trainer when I was in grad school, and I realized I did not like it. I'll tell you that. I did not like it because I felt like clients tend to be quite whiny. They're complaining, oh my God, my percent fat went from 18 to 19%. I'm like, it actually didn't. But that's what the number says. It says it's 19. Last week it was, I'm like, no. So I guess the broad question is this: when you're doing body composition assessments, obviously in the field, skin folds are probably the most common, although you're probably much better at this than all of us. I bet you could probably look at someone over the course of months and almost guess their percent fat better than maybe, you know, skin folds or DEXA or whatever. Talk in broad terms about body composition assessment and how much, and the fact that there's so much error between different methods.
Yeah, it's funny. You talked about just visualizing, because, you know, we've all seen those charts floating around online, like, this is what 4% body fat looks like, all the way up to like over, you know, 50%. We were joking the other day, I can't remember who I was joking with. We were talking about maybe we should actually run a study and like have a few people who have done a lot of tests. And that's one method we're comparing. It's just like the eyeball test. And unfortunately, it probably would perform better than some of these methods people use. But obviously, you couldn't, you know, it couldn't scale lab to lab, but it'd be kind of, you know, entertaining to look at. But no, absolutely. When you're talking about like the example you gave, you're talking about 1% difference in body fat, even by our best methods, would be interpreted with some skepticism. And this is hard because you can find, you know, you can find error rates in the literature for, you know, everything from skin folds up to DEXA. But as you know, I mean, say skin folds are a great example. It completely depends on the person doing it. There are some people who are incredible at skin folds and they can get some great, clean, high quality data. There are other gyms where you walk in and like, you know, whichever personal trainer is on, you know, on the clock that day will whip out the skin folds and like do it real quick. So yeah, there are certainly some methods like skin folds are particularly dependent on, you know, who's performing the assessment. Those that aren't, so like our lab focuses a lot on technology that might scale to, settings where, you don't have a trained assessor. So we're looking increasingly at like mobile applications, particularly with like 3D scanning or something like that. But even then there's so many factors going into it. Like if certain techniques, I'll pick on bioimpedance, because right next to the skin fold calipers at lots of gyms, you have the little old handheld Omron, yep, video game controller.
Wait, that's still around?
They're still around. Yeah. So You know, ones like that where people are just walking again, not standardized. They've, you know, either just exercised, they've had food to eat, fluid to drink, all kinds of things that can just introduce noise. So for some of those poor methods, you would need a really large change in body composition for the device to confidently tell you it's occurred. And by that point, you know, like the person would know by that point, they're like, I know my body comp has changed before this, you know, little device is telling me. So I don't know if you want to get into methods in particular, or if there's a direction you want to go with that.
Yeah, it's I think skin folds would be one to talk about the error rate. And let's say you're dealing with a skilled tester. That's number one. And then the more common ones, like for instance, we have a bod pod in our lab, but I don't think any of us have touched it in years because in essence, it's been replaced by the various in-body techniques because it's just so much faster. We could run athletes through it real quick. Bod pod takes forever. And then we also have a DEXA. So let's talk about DEXA, BIA, in-body, and then skin fold. So the typical error, and let's assume, this is a big assumption, let's assume, like, for instance, with the in-body, subjects come in under the same conditions, whether or not, let's say they're fasted for 3 hours, they haven't exercised, et cetera, et cetera. So we're assuming the best case scenario.
Yeah. Yeah. So there, I can throw out some tentative numbers. I hesitate to do that because it really does depend, even with something like DEXA, it depends some on the facility, the standardization, how well you position people, all that. And you know, many research settings, I'm sure our lab tries this as well. We're as meticulous as we can be, but you know, I've seen some things, you know, not any names, but I've seen, you know, in athletics departments where, you know, someone will be doing a heavy workout. They like literally drop the barbell in their last set and the dietitian pops out and like, hey, come over here, lay down the DEXA. They're just dripping sweat on it. They scan them and interpret the data.
Wait, something just came to mind. Sorry, Tony. Sorry to interrupt you, Grant. If you got a guy who's longer than the DEXA, right?
Yeah.
But they still want to get DEXA'd. Like we get a lot of like high level pro athletes and also college athletes coming in. Do you cut off the head or you cut off the feet?
Yeah. So the ideal thing to do, which is a little bit labor intensive, is to perform two partial scans. So you would include the head, scan till you get low enough and you have a discernible bony landmark, like say you're looking at a certain rib or something, pause the scan, save that, and you'll analyze up to that point, then reposition them higher, scan the rest of the body. And then you essentially, after the fact, draw the box at each point. So it's right at the same bony landmark. And then you sum those together. That'd be the ideal. Cause if you say just like cutting off the head or cutting off the feet, it's tricky to hit right at the same place. If you had to do that, I would say cut off the head. Cause that would be easier on the regions of interest to like say hit the collarbone or something like that. But assuming you're not doing a one-time assessment and you're tracking them over time, the really critical part is just making sure you're assessing the same mass. Cause if you have a couple slices more there, you might see these fat-free mass fluctuations, for example, that aren't real. It's just like how much their body got in that time.
Makes sense. Now, Tony, yeah. Tony works with a lot of fighters. So when they go through a cut, Tony, describe the changes in body weight that you might see with both male and female fighters. And then Grant, comment on how that might impact the assessment of body composition.
Yeah. So, and it does bring me to a question too, Grant, like would skin fold, and just, I'll end with the question, but if things are done correctly, hopefully we'll see a nice linear decline, but you know, because the problem in fighting, as you know, is it's very much like even to date, the UFCPI has changed this thankfully, but it's very freelance still in nature. You have your own camp, your own coaches, and everybody's pretty much doing their own thing in order to make weight or have a linear decline or longitudinal weight loss, I should say. So we'll see probably percentages depending upon what happens in, if you want to call it a general prep phase, because sometimes athletes are not even doing general prep, but hopefully we'll see a decline in ranges of 5, 6, 7%. And if you're not utilizing DEXA, obviously it's extremely difficult to get any feel for the lean muscle tissue loss, which is inevitable no matter how hard you try. But the general weight loss or percentages of 12 to 13% in that range from a start of camp, if you will, to the day we pretty much get to fight week. And then you'll have maybe a percent or two, well, a little more than that even. Let me take that back. 3-4% if the athlete has done everything well of water loss. So you'll see declines in percentages. Usually these men will go in about 13, 14% when camp starts above the scale. That is above scale weight, right? So if the weight was 200 pounds, they're 226. make the math easy. And those are the general numbers and what we're seeing in decline. One question he has, and I've utilized different methods. When I can't get to the lab, I've used the ultrasound. I don't, you know, it's had some advantages. But I would ask this, Grant, too, as we talk about fighting. I would assume in skinfold practices, the leaner the individual, potentially the greater the accuracy, right? Because we don't have a lot of hidden visceral fat, IAM fat that we're not picking up that we would get on the DEXA or potentially BOD pod or another modality. Might I be correct there actually?
Yeah. So I'm not, off the top of my head, I'm not aware of concrete data, but my knee jerk would be absolutely to agree with that. And yeah, certainly if you're thinking about the other ends of the spectrum, say individuals with obesity, even just like the accuracy of how you can grab and like palpate the skin fold correctly, I think there's some issues there. So yeah, I'd say in leaner individuals, not only like you're saying limited fat, like say around the organs, but even your ability to be confident about that, double skin folds you're grabbing. Yeah.
Right. Yep. Yep. But again, that's the weight loss trajectory. If you wanted to follow up, Joey, on what modalities we would use. And that's generally what we say. We've become better at it. And I want to credit the UFCPI and a lot more science and individuals like yourself putting out data that really gives us all a better hold on body composition, manipulating it, managing it, and simultaneously lean tissue preservation, which is the greater goal in any type of athletic performance, because there's a commensurate loss in speed, power, obviously, and strength with that loss of lean tissue.
Well, let me ask you this, because we, you know, in our lab, a lot of the college athletes, the coaches want them body comped, and it's always the in body because it's fast. I mean, we can run so many people through. So, and of course, we're assuming they're coming in under the same conditions, which of course they're not. We already know that. I mean, there are some who literally are eating right before they get on the scale. I mean, so it's all over the place. But here's my question. So and I'm not a body composition guy. I use it as a tool, but I'm not someone who follows literature. If you look at data as a group, so let's say we test 100 track and field guys or girls, and we follow the aggregate of the group over time, that data is correct. Correct, Grant, for the most part, right? If you look at the group.
Right. Yes. There are many methods that could track a group, a large group level change like that. Yes.
Okay. But now let's deal with an individual. Let's say it's just, you know, it's the heptathlete. And she's like, I want my body comp data and I want to see what I'm like from freshman to senior year. When you look at individual data, and let's say, you know, she goes from 20% to 19% to 20% to 19 to 18. Are any of these changes real? And how much of a change does it have to be for one person where you're like, okay, the change is real? And the problem we have is that all these athletes are, I'm like, visually, all of you look lean to me. I mean, I don't know if there's a difference between 18 and 19%. I mean, you look the same. So how much does it have to be for it to be a real change?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So as a broad principle, and I think you know this even from how you were asking the question, in general, the individual level accuracy of device, so the accuracy for assessing an individual is always worse than group level. Because group level, some of these, you know, random errors, people who have, you know, different tissue properties that cause a particular type of error in a device, lots of that cancels out. Some of the noise cancels out. You have a large group, particularly if they're doing some standardized or, you know, relatively similar intervention, you can get those trends. The issue is, yeah, you're pulling out one data point and you don't know if that's that person that's just tracking right on the group trend, or if this is one of those people with, say, random, I'll call it tissue properties here. We can get into it if we want, but for any method, again, with the numbers you gave there, you could be doing not only DEXA, you could be doing like a multi-compart model where you're doing DEXA and BOD pod and, you know, like dilution techniques for the water and super taking hours to do this. Even then, if you're seeing like, again, a singular percent at a time, even 2% at a time, highly questionable if you can interpret that as a true change. So, you know, not everyone does this. I was, you know, speaking on this topic recently, and I was recommending, knowing most people wouldn't do it, recommending that, you know, every lab who's trying to, and this was in the context of say like, you know, sports RDs working with like traditional athletics teams, but recommending that they collect some reliability data where it's like, okay, you get a group of people, test them one morning, test them the next morning. I gave like a simple calculator. I'm like, here, you can just get a sense of the error, like how much variation would be reasonable to expect even one day to the next, even without formal stats. Like we've done this before. And it's like, okay, for a given technique, you know, maybe we see changes from one day to the next, which are not real, of up to 2%. then if we're tracking longitudinally and we see it change less than 2%, we know that, I know 6 months elapsed, but we've seen that big of a change in someone's body fat literally from Tuesday to Wednesday when they reported to the lab the same way. So, I mean, again, not everyone's going to do that, but that sort of line of thinking of seeing like, okay, just from, we'll call it biological error, even if you were fasted, just minor differences in your body and your hydration state, you know, contents of your body and so on, we can see those several percent changes. Hope that exercise should make people skeptical of any small changes. The issue, and some of these are great technologies, but take Dexter or something, it looks so precise. I mean, it's so fancy. It's the X-ray. It comes out, they see the report, you know, body fat, you know, reported out to the, like the 10th or 100th place. And people interpret it like that. They're like, yeah, yeah, you know, I'm 11.83% body fat. And it's just, I mean, we know this. It's just not the case that it's that precise.
So on a practical level, let's say you get 20 of the same like cross-country runners, test them on Monday, test them on Wednesday or whatever, and just see what the error is there. Basically, you're just looking at the differences in the mean. And I'm assuming the standard deviation would be similar.
Yeah, you can do that. There are a few, one just like quick and dirty metric I like, those kind of wise gain there would just be like a maximum absolute difference. So like if you're wanting to err on the really skeptical side, you're like, what's the biggest change we saw in a person from one day to the next day or 2 days later when we standardized everything? And that's kind of a worst case scenario, but you could run, yeah, so like, you know, formal reliability stats on that and get more like what would be a, you know, average error we would expect. But yeah, to get back to your question, it always relates to like how confident are you? There's some metrics like in general with body comp, a really common error metric is the standard error of the estimate. And it's interpreted, you could think of it interpreted sort of like a standard deviation where we're going out like in a normal population where we're encompassing maybe, you know, 68% of the errors. But there's another individual level metric, which is the limits of agreement, that's like 95% confidence. And those error rates, if you look at for body fat percentage, get really large. Like a really good limits of agreement might be 4%. And that would mean, you know, if you test someone and they're 16%, they could be 20, we're 95% confident they're between 20% and down to 12%. So again, point being, like throwing, at that point, you're like, yeah, yeah.
That's like throwing darts in a dark room.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So class, if you take
a little, yeah, that's a little much in a weight class sport too, if you're really trying to isolate what's left there and what we got to get rid of. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So it's challenging at the individual level. I think for a practitioner, hopefully if they're working, you know, say with high level combat athlete, you know, whoever, probably their like individual expertise as a practitioner paired with the body comp assessments is probably a good way to go. Not leaning too heavily on the body comp assessments, but maybe seeing you're like, okay, I've seen this person do this before and I know they tend to whatever assess high at these points and we can still get the, you know, the trend we're looking for and so on.
Now we've tested a lot of, college football players, professional fighters and whatnot. And Tony can attest to this. We, on the DEXA, we have not gotten a single human being under 10%. For what, and we're talking about people who are, you look at them, you're like, I can see your pancreas. I mean, you are lean. this is a question as it relates to when we, I mean, Tony teaches exercise physiology. I actually teach sports and nutrition about the concept of essential fat, right? And I guess I've never believed the numbers because I don't know how they came up with the numbers of, well, human males need this much fat and human females need this much fat. Is there something about our DEXA that we cannot get a human being under 10%? Is it, are there people under 10%? That's one. Is there a limitation of the technology? And is that contributing to this artificial, like nobody is ever under 10% on our DEXA?
Yeah. So, what DEXA scanner do you have?
It's a
brand.
It's a Hologic.
Hologic. Okay. Yeah. So I'd say my strongest suspicion for why you haven't seen someone under 10. So first answer, I'd say there are people under 10%. Good question on the origins of essential fat. It's a little bit murky. You can look back to like, there's a 1975, you know, governmental report that's like hundreds of pages long that, you know, like detail some of this, but still a little bit murky. I would say that the software version, so like what's being done with the data matters a lot. So, you know, back at Baylor, we had Hologic DEXAs and there was literally like one checkbox in the software that was this particular correction. And it would intentionally change the body fat percentage by like 5%. So like if you want to feel good about yourself, you know, you can like change the settings and be like, oh yeah, here I am at, you know, 8%. But then, you know, you change the setting. It's like, okay, now reanalyze the same scan. It shows 13%. And there was actually a reason for that, came from analysis where they thought DEXA was overestimating fat. So they, you know, led to this correction. So I'd say the software and details of the software saying could be part of it. And that's a good example where, you know, it might not make your lean people feel happy when they're coming in and they're like, wait, I'm 11%. I'm positive. I'm, you know, single digit, but it wouldn't change the device Dex's ability to track the change. So like if you're tracking a change, like, okay, you know, you went from 15 to 13. If we analyze this differently, maybe you went from like 10 to 8. But really the take home message is the same, even though I know when you hand that printout, no one is happy typically with their Dex results.
Hey, Tony, you know, we have a friend, Chris Algieri, a professional fighter. He swears he can get below 10, but on that DEXA, Tony, he's been like 10.9, 11.0. I mean, and he's like ripped to the bone.
Yeah. And that's in fight shape. And the other approaches, caliper, ultrasound, we didn't throw him in the bod pod, but certainly impedance, they all had him, oh gosh, you know, the 5.5-5.6 range. Which I would often get, by the way, or obtain, usually with fighters from about a welterweight or lightweight, 155 down. Those numbers were pretty consistent on the other measurements. But, you know, you just don't get enough of them to the DEXA. It's not always easy and practical. But quick question, Grant. I mean, so you've seen with some frequency. So Joey was asking single digits then with some athletes. Is that correct? Like,
yeah. And I'll say most of the people we test aren't true athletes. We test lots of bros and girls who lift and stuff, you know, so people with very, you know, we've done physique athletes, it's various states of being off season, closer to prep and competition and so on. Right. So we do have some single digit, but it'd be the person walking around where like, you can tell they're pretty shredded to get down there. But yeah, I would say if you want to chat offline, we can and look and see whether or not you want to, you know, uncheck this box if you have it in your settings, if you want to start making people feel a little better. You just obviously wouldn't want to compare from an old scan to a new scan to be like, yeah, you just mysteriously dropped a 5% body fat. I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, I'm going to look for that box because I want to make me feel better too. So.
Yeah.
Now, from a pragmatic point of view, let's just deal with two methods, the DEXA and the InBody, the BIA.
Yeah.
Because it's the ones at least we most commonly use. We'll leave skin folds out for now. Is there, and assuming conditions are right, they come in, let's say they're fasted, they haven't exercised, whatever the conditions are. So those conditions are perfect. Is there a difference if you test people who are lean, and let's say lean is 15% or less, versus those middle range or in the 20 percentages, maybe up to 25%? Versus the ones who are over 30% fat, is there a difference in what you would call accuracy? Meaning, okay, with this group, it seems to work better. With the fat group, maybe not as well. And I'm just guessing. I don't know. That's why I'm asking you.
Yeah, there often is a difference. It's a little tricky because any study showing there is a difference. And what you're talking about, the idea of the, you know, statsy term we'd use for it is like proportional bias, meaning that like the agreement between two methods varies based on the level of whatever you're assessing. So in this case, level body fat in leaner individuals, maybe we're seeing an overestimation of body fat. But in individuals who are less lean, we're seeing an underestimation. And that is very common. But it's always relative to what you're comparing to. So DEXA and BIA, this is a good example. You know, everyone likes to herald DEXA, and DEXA is a great technique. It really is. But it has different principles it's using than BIA. So if you compare, like say in your lab with the DEXA and the BIA, you compare them, you will likely see proportional bias. We've seen this like many times over where like in the leaner individuals, you might have, you know, an overestimation, and it can depend some, the direction of it can depend a little bit on the, you know, DEXA software, like we were just talking about in the specific BIA device. But where you see a different relationship in leaner individuals, pretty better group level agreement in that intermediate body fat range. And then worse as you get higher, say above, you know, 30, 40%. So yes, that definitely happens. But again, it just depends on what you're comparing to. And if you're comparing like DEXA and BIA, they are, if you're talking about InBody, they're both really good techniques. They're just using different principles. So we should expect some level of disagreement when the actual biophysical principles being used by the techniques differ. Yeah, so that's a long answer to a short question. Right.
Yeah, we actually did a comparison of the InBody to the DEXA, and consistently, and the BOD pod as well. Excuse me, consistently, the InBody and the BOD pod are about 4% lower in percent body fat than the DEXA. The DEXA always is the one that makes people cry, but yeah, they all love the InBody and the BOD pod because they're leaner on it. So, and it's a fairly consistent difference.
Yeah.
But we're mostly testing lean. I mean, we're mostly testing lean people. So I don't know what it's like for the overweight or the average person. I mean, we're mostly testing athletes. So maybe it's just with athletes, you see that 4% difference with in-body versus DEXA, bod pod versus DEXA.
Yeah, and you certainly could if your population is fairly homogenous that way. We do a lot of studies where we're sort of validating technologies in, I'll call them the general population, that we're in a kinesiology department, so we get a lot of active people, but we'll often have ranges again of sub 10% body fat to like at 50% body fat and pretty good representation throughout that whole range. So we were probably set up to see some of those differences where we're seeing really different level of agreement and very lean and people with relatively high adipose tissue.
One last question, Tony, if you have another one as well, pipe in. One last question before I want to switch over a little bit, talk about intermittent fasting. From a sort of bird's eye point of view, the value of body composition assessment in general for athletics, we're talking about athletic performance. What's the value of it? Are there some sports where it's completely meaningless and other sports where it's completely meaningful? And I'm sure Tony has an opinion on this. So what do you think, Grant?
I think they're probably, I won't go like sport by sport per se, but I think there are plenty of contexts where you could argue it's meaningless. There are probably contexts where you could argue, I'm positive, body composition assessments in some contexts have done more harm than good. Whether it's the practitioner, the athlete, someone mistakenly interpreting these as gospel truth. So like maybe, I love body composition assessment. I love the technology. I love the stats. It's something we do, but I feel like most of the time when I'm talking about it, I'm sort of de-emphasizing or recommending that people de-emphasize the results and say like, if performance is tracking the right way, like subjective factors, psychological factors, all these things are trending in the right direction and they get a bad body comp test. You shouldn't be like jumping programs and being like, okay, we need to reevaluate everything. We're going to change all this. And again, I think appreciating the error of the device, and I'm hoping eventually, maybe if I stay on whatever enough podcasts and things, practitioners, researchers, all of us will just be a little more cautious and be like, yeah, that 19% to 20% or to 20.5% for this technique in our facility, doesn't mean anything. And I'm going to interpret it appropriately to the athlete, say like, based on the error of our device, there was no change in your body comp. And maybe, I don't know, do you withhold the information? Do you not? But the interpretation hopefully would get there where it's like, okay, at this point, yeah, now you've actually increased body fat compared to, this time 6 months ago or whatever.
Well, it's funny. Yeah. Cause Tony, remember when John Jones fought Cyril Gane, everyone's like, Cyril Gane, he's built like a bodybuilder. Look at him. Look at his physique. And John Jones actually had a little bit of a belly, which was kind of interesting. Yet John Jones killed him. I mean, it wasn't even close. So, you see that in the fight sports. You can't look at a body. You can't. Look at Tyson Fury.
Right, right. Well, it's a little bit more, you have a little bit more liberty with that in the heavyweight division, right, where they were at the time. Because, when you got to make the scale, then the body fat matters. But to Grant's point, sometimes you got to be very... I would say diplomatic in how you present the information. You got to be very cautious too, because even fighters or athletes that are looking to make weight class can get fixated on it. And either that if you haven't made significant progress according to one measurement modality, then they think they're not making progress. If they're at a very low number, then they're going to panic and go, well, where the hell is the rest of the weight come from? So generally the numbers I've always used have really been for me. And it becomes important because you want to know what is the estimated contribution to making weight from fat loss. And that's all it is. It's an estimate, because I can't account for what lean tissue loss is going to be. No matter how hard you try to mitigate it, it occurs. Water turnover and all the contributing factors that lead to scale weight. But I have used it exactly to your point, Grant, very, very cautiously when presenting that information. In the beginning of camp, I actually think it has the greatest value, where I can say, hey, you're this percent body fat. If we get around here, we're going to lose about 8 to 9 pounds. That's going to be a great contribution towards making weight. We know that you usually turn over easily 3 to 4 pounds of water per training session. So boy, I think we're going to arrive at the scale quite comfortably. In that capacity, it gives us a, hey, take I-95 north and just stay on I-95 north and then worry about getting off later. But I'm agreeing with you too, that athletes can become obsessed with it. And particularly in sports where I think the demand on both cosmetic, like a gymnastics sometimes, or ice skating, you got to be really cautious in how you present that information and utilize it prudently. Yep.
Yeah, I love when also in the con. Yeah, it's really an interesting context with the combat sports. I think what you said is perfect of emphasizing most or putting most weight on that initial body comp assessment and kind of planning your route from there, because they're doing all kinds of things as they get closer to weighing in that may cause the devices to go crazy. I mean, you're even trying to standardize and stuff, but yeah, body water, all kinds of things that they could pull a really weird result. So I love what you said of kind of using that initial one back when they're in a little bit of a more normal physiological state and kind of basing your direction off there rather than being like, whatever, I don't know the details of it, but you're a couple of weeks out and you did an assessment and you're like, whoa, it looks like you lost all this lean mass, but whatever, their body fluids and so on are way different than they were back at the initial assessment.
You hit it perfectly. They're liable to get struck by lightning come a week out with their electrolyte balance and fluid balance if they're on an impedance scale. So you're absolutely right. Best time is in the beginning.